I imagined people at home listening to it, actually not often sailors, because I don't think that many of them did. It surprises me when people know who I am, always surprises me, because I knew how slaughtered Radio 4 would be if we were that insensitive.
Conversations, an occasional Radio Moment series in which we talk to those who made a difference. Alice Arnold.
Radio 2 had a huge influence, and we had Junior Choice, and I used to get into bed, as most people did, with their parents in the morning, with my dad, because Mum was always doing certain things, but I'd get into bed with Dad and we'd listen to Junior Choice and Ed Stewpot and all that.
Anyway, happy birthday to our Auntie Kerry, who lives at Woodlawn, Carrickfergus, who is 12 years old on the 12th of October.
And I loved that. I thought that was... And then Mum would pick me up from school and listen to Wagoner's Walk. So I had a sort of drama influence from that, I suppose. So those were my main childhood, you know, very mainstream stuff.
And don't forget, you can hear an omnibus edition of Wagoner's Walk at 5 o'clock on Sunday afternoon here on Radio 2.
And then when I went to university, they had a Radio Falmer. This was Sussex University, and they had a show. I applied to do a show and to do songs from the musicals. So me and my friend Susanna had our little programme on Radio Falmer, which we were sure no one listened to. It was like 5 to 7 in the evening. We had no experience. I don't know how we managed to work the studio or anything. We brought in all our records and we played songs from the shows, and we'd have little competitions, like, you know, you win a Mars bar if you can get here first to the studio, and no one would come. So we assumed absolutely nobody was ever listening to our show. So it was quite funny and maverick type of radio programme. And then we were voted like the best radio show of film. So clearly one or two people were listening, which took us rather by surprise. So that was my first sort of broadcasting. I think Susanna still has some clips of it somewhere on tape. It would be hilarious to listen to. We'd sound like very ex-public school girls trying to be cool and trendy on Radio Falmer. But that was my initial sort of broadcasting.
There have been a good many changes in Wagoner's Walk since the 18th century, when the men who gave their name to the walk paused on the way up the hill to Hampstead to refresh their horses at the trough and themselves at the inn. The area has long since been engulfed by the sprawl of London, but something of the village atmosphere remains. Of course, not many of the inhabitants are Londoners by birth. Most have come from all corners of the country to live and work here, like the girl who's just stepped out of the taxi in this, the first episode called Moving Pictures.
Keep the change.
Oh, thank you, miss. Must have been some party.
It was.
My beginning of my career was university shored up for me the idea that I wanted to act. And so I did a lot of drama at university, and my poor father, who had to pay for drama school after university, wasn't that pleased, but he said, well, you can have a year of it and we'll see how it goes. So I auditioned for all the drama schools, on the understanding if I didn't get in, that was then telling me I wasn't good enough and I wouldn't go. So I didn't want it that much. But anyway, I did get in and I did go to drama school, and my first job was in Evita, the musical. So I could sing a bit. I don't dance. But I went to an open audition at the Prince Edward Theatre. Evita was closing in the West End and going to Manchester Opera House for a year. And I literally just left drama school, and it was, you know, sing a song. And so I did. And I think I can hit a low E. And I think they wanted someone who could hit a low E and would, as I say, fit the costume of the person who was leaving. And I fitted that. So massive surprise to me. They rang up and said, yes, you've got a job. And I remember saying to an old teacher of mine, am I meant to say yes to this? And he said, yes, unless you're meant to say yes to it. So that gave me a year's employment up in Manchester, which was great, and gave me a full equity card, because in those days you had to have an equity card, and I just had a provisional from doing cabaret. But this got me the full card straight away. And then I left, and I went into two other musicals, Oh, What a Lovely War and Godspell, and then did my first straight play at Coventry, which was The Prime of Miss Jean Brodie. And that was kind of my first feeling of I've come home. This is what I wanted to act for. I didn't want to be in big musicals singing in the chorus. That really wasn't my thing. I loved doing rep, and I was very lucky and got some wonderful jobs doing rep theatre. But while I was at drama school, I did the Carlton Hobbs Award, which is a competition for actors to all the drama schools enter it, and I think you send about six actors, and then the winner got a six-month contract with the radio drama company. Second place got some money, I think. Not very much, it was BBC. Third place, which I think was me, got to record some message on somebody's answer phone. That was about my price. However, I had been spotted by a couple of the directors who were judging that competition. So when I had left drama school after a year or so, I got approached to do a couple of radio plays. And that was the beginning of my radio drama. I think you had 6 months, 6 months and 6 months in those days. Now I think they give you about 6 weeks. But in those days, it was a company of 30 people.
What's this? Where? Ah, yes. You've got an eye for beautiful things. It's a paperweight. Lift it. It's heavier than you think.
And it was the best job ever. Absolutely fantastic. You would get your scripts and there'd be a chart and it would tell you what you were doing, and the studios were all in Broadcasting House. There was one in Maydevale and one at Bush, but most of them were in Broadcasting House, and you'd share a green room with people from different casts, from different companies, and one week you would be playing the lead, you know, opposite Julie Covington, and the next week you would be in a crowd in the French Revolution, and sometimes both in the same week, actually, and you'd go through one door and be a French peasant, and you'd go through another door and be an Australian something or other. It was the best fun, the best training. You worked with fantastic people and some amazingly clever radio artists, and it didn't cost anything to do it again. And that's what I loved about radio, is that the red light would go on and there'd be a little bit of adrenaline, but you knew that if you mucked it up, just do it again. All it costed was a bit of time. There wasn't a whole lot of resetting the stage and getting the costumes and all of that. It was pure, to me, pure acting. And actually, I never really enjoyed the stage experience that much. I wasn't a great one for showing off in front of big crowds. I liked the acting. I loved rehearsing. And radio drama, to me, was sort of like permanent rehearsal, really. You just got to work on it and try it again and try and be better and try and be more real, and you didn't have to learn your lines. So it was absolutely the dream job. I've rarely been happier in work than I was those. And then I went back on to the rep company a couple of years later and did another year's stint then.
Daft, if you ask me, Murgatroyd.
Well, yes, but what do you think it means?
A drink. That's what it means.
Oh, you think it's some sort of invitation?
We'll find out when we get there. Best we can hope for is a glass of bad sherry, I expect. You'd better get off the grass, Murgatroyd. You've still got your bedroom slippers on. They'll be soaked through.
Oh, dear. So they are. How many eggs today?
Seven. That damn hen.
Well, obviously the physical is taken out of it because you can't use that because you go off mic, and also you've got a script in your hand, so you know there is a problem with script noise, and you learn to work that very carefully. I had some hilarious instance with that. So what you have to concentrate on is getting all the emotion into the voice, and that is difficult because you naturally use your, I mean, you do as much physicality as you can because otherwise it does constrict the voice, I think, but you know, things like remembering to smile and remembering, you know, you've just got to concentrate all that into a voice. And there are certain voices that just work beautifully on radio. And most of those voices would also work very well on stage. It's certainly not an exclusive, mutually exclusive thing. But there are actors, I think, who are just particularly good at radio drama in a way that their voice conveys the emotion more than their other physicality does.
It's a funny way to put it, don't you think?
Probably all cooked up by Patrick and Julia. Where's that damned hen got to? Come here, you brute!
There are funny things you have to do when you know you've got to pretend you're doing physical exertion, and obviously you're not. And I mean, it was, we had some funny moments. Though there used to be a selection, I think there still is, of skirts. because for historical dramas there would be ballroom scenes and things and you needed to get swishing of skirts, but that involved everybody wearing one, so that was all the boys in one as well. And there, I worked with some wonderful people who would just made me laugh more. I mean, there would be tears of laughter doing radio drama crowd scenes that were just more fun than you could imagine. But nowadays, of course, that was in the days when there were 30 people on the radio drama company. Now there's about 8, I think, or maybe 10, but certainly those big plays don't exist anymore because they can't afford to do them. So we would have a week to do an hour-long play, and with a cast of hundreds, and nowadays they would have, you know, to do an hour-long play in a day with a cast of three. You know, that's the kind of way drama, radio drama's gone, and I'm sort of sad for that because they're no longer the big epics. I loved doing kind of two-handers and things. They were great fun as well, but there was something special about doing... And also what I loved about it, which was ruined for me once I did a lot of radio drama, but is that your imagination can take you anywhere. It can take you to India, it can take you to the northeast, it can take you anywhere without having to build a set. And when you're listening to it, you can absolutely you form your own pictures, and I love that. It's a very personal media. I think you need to listen probably to radio drama on your own, and nearly everybody does. They're listening in a car or they're listening at home on their own. It's not the collective thing that watching television can be. And so it's very private and very personal, and your own mind makes the pictures. And I absolutely love that. I love my own imagination. Sadly, I can do that again now, but because I haven't done any radio drama for a while. But when I used to do it, then all I could see was my friend standing in front of a microphone, and that was the only picture I could conjure up. But I think for people who've never seen a radio studio or whatever, the pictures that they can form are wonderful. And more like reading a book, I suppose, when you build your own set and you picture the people and you imagine what they look like. And I think I love it, absolutely love it. I do miss it. If someone rang me up tomorrow and said, Alice, we've got a part in a play. And actually, it's one of the reasons I left my job as a newsreader, because I was stopped from doing a radio play. Not from news. News were happy for me to do it. But certain people at Radio 4 were not, and I was pretty upset.
In part one of Agatha Christie's A Murder is Announced, Miss Marple was played by June Whitfield. Detective Inspector Craddock, Ian Lavender. Sir Henry Clithering, Graham Crowden. Letty Blacklock, Sarah Lawson. Dora Bunner, Judy Cornwall. Colonel Easterbrook, Jack Headley. Laura Easterbrook, Joanna McCullum. Miss Hinchliffe, Elizabeth Bell. Miss Murgatroyd, Alice Arnold.
Peter Donaldson was a huge factor in that. The wonderful Peter Donaldson, who I adored. He used to do announcements for the plays, so he would read the cast list. You'd have the announcer would come in and read the cast list, and then, being Peter, would also come to the end of show drinks, which were nearly always in a studio somewhere. It was nothing fancy, believe me, but you know, we'd all have a glass of wine in the studio at the end of the play, and Peter was there, and I got to know him, and I said I could do that linky thing with the programmes, because at that point, you know, I wasn't acting all the time. I think I must have not been on the radio drama company. I must have been, because there were times in between when I was freelancing and in a lot of radio plays, but not working full time. And I thought, well, that would be a good sort of day job. I could do that linky thing.
And now, just before our next programme, a repeat of the motorway warning for drivers southbound.
I didn't know how to run a studio or what it involved, and Peter said, oh, we'll come in and, you know, we'll give you a test. He didn't use the word test because he wouldn't. Anyway, he sat me down and gave me a shipping forecast to read, which was an unmitigated disaster. I mean, I had no idea how to say any of the names, how to say the numbers, none of it. And I finished that and he said, yes, I think we could, we'll take you on as a, you can learn to do that. Well, it took me quite a long time to learn because you used to just follow somebody. And the first person I followed was a guy called Andy Crawford, who was had come to it from a studio management point of view and knew everything technical, and I knew nothing technical. So he showed me a self-op studio, getting on the daily service in the morning, which is the first thing you had to do yesterday in Parliament and the daily service. And I just thought, I can't do this. There's no way I can operate all these knobs. And in those days, we had things on tape that went round and round. And you had to put the tape on the machine and play it out. I had no idea how to do any of it. So after a few months, I think, I could sort of just about manage to get a daily service on.
Christ is made the sure foundation.
It almost made me believe in God, actually, because the thing actually went out on air. Such a miracle. And but then I, you know, as you do with these things, you do learn. And I spent a lot of time then freelancing, doing just continuity for radio, not news at that point, because I knew that if I did news, I couldn't act anymore, because you probably couldn't be a drama had told me I couldn't be a newsreader and act. And in fact, I had another name. I was Katie Arnold when I did continuity, and Alice Arnold for drama, because I was doing a lot of both, and I was announcing myself in the plays, you know, reading my own name out as being on the cast list, and that was slightly awkward. Yeah, I had this other name, and then I dropped that because everyone guessed that it was the same person anyway, and it just seemed a bit silly.
Well, this is BBC Radio 4 on 92 to 95 FM, 198 Long Wave and Digital Radio. It's Tuesday, the 4th of September, and I'm Alice Arnold. Good morning.
So I didn't do news until I had decided that I would go staff at the BBC and give up the drama side of things, really.
BBC News. This is Peter Donaldson.
He was just a joy. He was like a sort of cuddly uncle, and he ran the department in the most sort of convivial, non-judgmental way, which was an old style of BBC management, I think, in that he would ring you up if you got something wrong and manage to tell you that you'd got something wrong without belittling you, without making you feel that your job was in jeopardy, and, that it was fine. If you got something wrong in that job, you felt dreadful enough about it anyway. You didn't need someone else to tell you off. But so Peter managed that side of things brilliantly, and also he did all those awful shifts himself. So he managed the department from also being a newsman. He did news, but he would give himself all the worst shifts. And that gave him massive respect from everybody. I don't think there were, you know, everybody just had huge respect and love for him. And that was something that got lost in recent years in the BBC, I think. I mean, he was a total maverick. He was wicked. I mean, there was that story about him when he hated that programme, and he listed all these other stuff. And I'd heard that story lots of times, but I didn't sort of... But I thought, I bet he didn't really say that. But when he died, someone had found that clip, and he really did say that, which made me respect him even more, because in those days, you know, he could have been sacked for it. Nowadays, certainly would have been sacked for it. But he said what he thought, and he was wonderful about the whole, you know, when management at the BBC came in with all these schemes they would do, Make It Happen and Creative Future and all that. He wasn't having any of it. And he would just tear bits of paper up and put them in the bin and then ring up, you know, Greg Dyke or whatever and say, I'm not doing it. Instead of just ignoring it and lying low, he wouldn't do that. He'd go and say it. But you always felt that he had your back. He was on your side. Whatever you did, Peter was on your side, and we all loved him, and it was desperately sad when he died last year.
It's just been announced from Downing Street that Mrs. Thatcher is to resign.
In presentation, there was Brian Perkins, obviously, and Brian and Peter were like, you know, a sort of gang, and they did seem like these, you know, sort of legends to me when I joined.
Here is the general synopsis at 0700 GMT.
But there was a different culture at the BBC, some of which probably wasn't great in those days, but there was a terrific drinking culture. And that affected drama probably more than it affected continuity and announcing and presentation. But, you know, really very little work was done in the afternoon. You know, you would do you would rehearse or do whatever you're doing in the morning, and then everybody would go to the BBC club. And that's how you got your next part in your next play or your next shifts or whatever it was, by socialising with everybody in the club. I don't really drink, and I certainly don't hold my alcohol very well. So I banned myself from going to BBC parties after a while because I would say things that I really oughtn't to say. So I just said I'm never going to another one because I will jeopardise my career. But the office, you know, we used to move a lot in Radio 4 presentation. I suppose they still do at the BBC, but you would be in one office for a couple of years, then you'd move to another office. And I was always the technical bimbo. I mean, I knew nothing technically. I still really know nothing technically. And I remember a chap trying to teach me how to edit tape with bits of yellow and chalk and razor blades and things. And then I'd let this machine go mad and all the yellow stuff spooled off, literally all over the floor. And then one of the bosses came in to the bar, to the office, and Steve Doherty, who then went on to be a comedy producer and everything, but in those days was the most junior of juniors in our office, picked up all the yellow tape and hid it behind his back until the chap had left to protect me, because he knew that someone would say, well, what is that all doing on the floor? I was hopeless, and still pretty hopeless. But then in later days, we went self-op, which was even more technical. And I kind of was quite good at that. I don't know why. I learnt that business quite quickly and found that quite easy and quite enjoyed being in control completely of the desk. In the early days, we had a studio manager through the glass, apart from this early morning split for Long Wave, where we did have to do some technical stuff. But basically, you had a studio manager at the other side of the glass who managed everything. So you had to do the timings and work out what you were going to say. So in those days, the voice and how you delivered it was the most important thing. Of course, once we went self-op and there was more technical stuff to do, they had to employ people who could do that. But Peter Donaldson was always just he was a voice person. You know, the voice and how you presented was the most important thing. You didn't really have to know very much about technical side because somebody else was doing it.
Jim Al-Khalili meets Professor Richard Dawkins and asks, would he rather be known for his science than his atheism? That's in the Life Scientific at 9 o'clock this morning after the Today programme. But first, a look ahead to Friday and some hard-hitting news stories.
I'm not sure you can teach someone how to read. I think you can guide somebody. I think Peter was very much concerned that you didn't put on a voice or be a different person from yourself. And he had a thing about actors, and he said some can do that and some can't. And so that was really the litmus test with me, was could I be myself and do it, or would I be putting on a performance and not being real? And I think that was his concern, and I sort of, as far as he was concerned, passed that test. But I don't think he talked. He just pointed up little things that he thought could be improved on, but as I said, always with a positive spin on it. Yeah, this was Peter's thing, that at the end of a moving drama or whatever, you should leave a pause so long that it hurts. And pausing is difficult on radio, but I think I always understood, because I came from a drama background, that those pauses were essential. It didn't worry me so much to do that, because if you're listening to the output, you're with the listener and you are feeling what they're feeling, and so you know, you just feel the right time to come in. Television ruins it now with that. You know, you'll see the most moving drama and they come splashing in with the trail for the next program and you can't even see the credits, and it absolutely kills me every time they do it, because part of the whole experience, like when you go to see a play in the West End, part of the experience is the curtain call. There was a very near miss that we had on radio where I was doing continuity in the morning, and Prince Charles had just announced his engagement to Camilla. And one of the things that you always did, this was in the days when we still had studio managers, but you used to top and tail a programme before you played it. You listened to the beginning of it, you listened to the end of it, so you knew what was coming up. And I'd listened to the post 9 o'clock programme, which in those days was a 15-minute thing. Anyway, it was to do with music, and it began with the music used in Princess Diana's funeral, and that's what it was taken from. And I thought, we cannot play this immediately after a news bulletin which announces that Charles is getting married to Camilla. That we will be slaughtered for that. So that was another of my calls to Mark Damaser, saying, we need to change it, I need to play something else, I need to, and that's a major thing, because you have to find another program. And we do have a sort of standby set of, you know, innocuous programs about wildlife or something that can't offend anybody, but I did stick in another program and said, you know, I'm not playing that, whatever anyone says, I'm informing you rather than getting your permission, because I knew how slaughtered Radio 4 would be if we were that insensitive. You know, in those days, obviously, Diane's death was much closer, and you did have to look out for those sort of faux pas that people would make. Oh, Radio 4 listeners would definitely notice.
Thanks, Nick. This is BBC Radio 4. It's 5:30 on Tuesday, the 4th of September. Good morning. This is News Briefing with Alice Arnold. David Cameron is putting the final touches to his first major government reshuffle. London Metropolitan University is beginning legal action against the Border Agency, which
I suppose I was about, maybe I'd hit 40 by then, maybe not. Can't remember exactly what year it was, but I decided that I had enough of sort of doing rep in distant parts of the country and living in digs with no central heating and wanted more to settle down. So I decided to go for a staff job. Well, no, before that, I did read the news on Radio 2 for a couple of years at night. That was a killer. And then I decided I would go for a staff job on Radio 4. Once I'd got that, then they immediately said to me, well, now you have to read the news. And very quickly, I was into the Today programme and doing all the news shifts. So there's a kind of hierarchy in news reading that, you know, you start with the late news and then you get a day news and then you go. And some people, they seem to spend years getting people to all the stages. But anyway, I was sort of fast-tracked into, right. It was John Humphreys, it was James Naughtie, it was Sarah Montague. Justin Webb had started while I was there, I think. And Evan Davis had started while I was there. But when you say working on the Today programme, the news in the Today programme is written on a different floor from where the Today programme is produced. Certainly was. I left just before new broadcasting house came into operation, so I left that week, actually.
Here in this new studio, the Today programme studio, we've been joined by Her Majesty the Queen and the Director General of the BBC, Lord Hall of Birkenhead, for the formal opening.
So in those days, we were at White City, at Television Centre, and the news section of the Today programme is not necessarily integrated always harmoniously with the Today programme. So the Today programme is going on, and we as the newsreader would come in just before the hour or on the half hour, with our editor who would sit next to us. And when we did the news, the presenters, well, some of them, would quite often leave and not necessarily particularly acknowledge us. Not Sarah Montague was great, you know, and some of them would definitely make you feel like you were part of the gang. But there are other radio sequence programmes which would have made you feel more welcome as a newsreader than Today sometimes did. And that was then supposedly the end of me acting, although I was able to do Listen Against, which I loved, which was the sort of radio spoof series on feedback, really, was how it was based. John Holmes very cleverly wrote that, and there was some wonderful writing in it.
Hello, I'm Alice Arnold, and welcome to Listen Against, the radio programme on the radio that rewinds your ears backwards along the dial so that they have a chance to hear what they might have missed the first time around, only they were switched off. Coming up in the next half hour, we try and answer the question posed by this morning's Today programme.
Can listening to sounds like this...
Good morning, it's 5 Live Breakfast.
...with Nikki Campbell and Sheila Fogarty
help you to die?
Brian Perkins has the papers.
The Independent says that the British sprinter Dwayne Chambers will be reduced to 20 miles an hour. And under the headline, A Vision of Hell, our cricket correspondent, Jonathan Agnew.
And your thoughts on the BBC's first ever weather sponsor.
I remember, and it's terrible to say this, because usually when the newsroom is going, is really buzzing and it's full of adrenaline, is generally bad news. So I don't want to say I enjoyed bad news, because that would sound awful. But I do remember the night that Michael Jackson died, and I was the newsreader that night. And I think he died at about 9:30 or 10:00 in the evening. But being the BBC, we needed two independent witnesses for that. So we weren't announcing it yet. But we thought that when we did announce it, it would probably involve a break in programme. And that's about as serious as it gets if you actually interrupt a programme for a news bulletin. And you have to ring the controller, which in those days was Mark Damaser. It was my duty, so I rang Mark Damaser. This was now about 11:00 at night, I think. And Mark Damaser was clearly in bed with his wife, and she answered the phone. I need to speak to Mark. I said, Michael Jackson's died. And he said, oh, you mean General Sir Mike Jackson, the head of the army? And I said, no, I mean Michael Jackson, the singer. And he went, oh, right. No, that probably does involve breaking into programmes. As it happened, we didn't get absolute confirmation until it was time for the midnight news.
She's out of my life.
Because the Obits weren't really prepared for that, because that was such a surprise. That was a exciting night to be working, which I don't mean to say that I relished the demise of Michael Jackson. Obviously, I didn't, but it was, from a news point of view, an exciting time to be there. And like, I was also on when the Pope was elected, and that was fun because there was a list of possibilities, and it was the 6:00 news, and they hadn't announced before the news began. Now, there were about, I can't remember how many bishops there are, but there were 100 and something, quite a lot of whom had completely unpronounceable names, and you just had to hope that it was Ratzinger in the end, but you had to hope that it wasn't going to be one that you hadn't prepared, because that would have been a nightmare, and the news actually did break during the 6:00. And so, I mean, those moments were fantastic fun, and you know, you would hear things being shouted across the room, and oh, so-and-so's resigned, and this has happened, and this has happened, and I just, you know, in these last few days, speaking just after the European referendum, that newsroom must be a crazy place to be. You would have your script, and it would be ripped up and put on the floor, and a new one given to you, you know, every 5 minutes at the moment, and that to me was a great buzz. I enjoyed that. I enjoyed being sort of on the edge, not knowing what the next thing was going to be. And then we had great fun. I did a great exercise where we were all taken off to a secret location, which I think has been well and truly documented, but it was for a procedure because we do practice people obituary procedures when, you know, we rehearse those at the BBC. And this one was a sort of SARS attack or some sort of chemical attack on London. And we were all shipped off in a coach and taken to wherever it was. And then there was rather an interesting sort of friction between Radio 4 and 5 Live, because Radio 4 was, you know, the considered approach of the news, and 5 Live was the rolling news and the getting out there and talking to people and all of that. And there was this big debate about who was going to deliver the news at 1:00. And, you know, Radio 4 was standing firm going, it should be us. And 5 Live were going, no, it should be us. And I can't even remember who won. But those were quite funny, those exercises, and seeing the sort of the contrast between the different networks, because there are differences. You know, a Radio 4 newsreader is not the same as a 5 Live newsreader. It's a different audience and a different delivery.
Stay calm and stay in your own house. We shall be on the air every hour on the hour. Stay tuned to this wavelength, but switch your radios off now to save your batteries.
I mean, the smile is the most important thing, and I think people don't realise how much a smile comes through in the way that you sound. Because the muscles are different when you're smiling, and that affects your voice. And when I train people now to speak in presentations or in whatever media, they forget to smile, and they don't realise the effect that has on your voice. So, you know, if it's a light-hearted story, then please, please don't read it as if it isn't. Smile. I never mark a script at all, ever. I never did when I acted either. I highlighted my lines, but I never marked them. Other people mark literally that they're going to go up at the end of that sentence and down at the end. I can't. I have to speak the way I speak. If I started marking emphasis or inflection, I would be like a robot. I couldn't possibly mark a script and then go up, go down. I read it as I feel it. And I think one lesson I did learn, and I can't remember who told it to me, but quite often we'd have to do those dreadful announcements of soldiers being killed, and they would say, you know, has now been named as. And I would always try to do that as if I was a friend of that person and I didn't know, because I thought that was a really crucial piece, because there would be people listening to that who might have known the person that had just been named as being killed in Iraq or whatever. And I thought it was really important to read that in the most sensitive way that you could and not be blasé about it, because someone's going to hear that night and go, crumbs, I knew that person. No, not their immediate family, because they would obviously have been informed before we announced the name. That's why they say the name hasn't been announced yet, because they haven't told all the people that they think need to know. But there will be some more distant friends and people who wouldn't know. And I always felt it was important to read that as if they were here, you know, hearing it for the first time.
'40s, north 4 or 5, becoming variable 3 or 4, later fair, good. Chromaty, variable 3.
I think originally when I did it, I was a bit extreme and read it as if it was a poem, and people do think it is a poem. But there's a rhythm to it. It was a funny thing, the shipping forecast, that I think most announcers would dread in any bulletin, news or continuity, stuttering over their words or getting something wrong. And there was something about the shipping forecast that I don't think I ever did, because it just flowed. Obviously, the words were familiar as well. But once you got into a rhythm of it, I found it almost impossible to make a mistake. Which didn't mean that I was concentrating that hard, because you would be thinking, timing was the most important thing. So I would mark up. So I didn't mark my script. I did to say I must be at North at 0 by 1 minute 30, you know, if otherwise I'm going to crash the pips. So I would just have the marks of where I should be time-wise. And you knew that I roughly knew you could do 3 coastal stations in 15 seconds or whatever. You sort of could work that one out. Otherwise, yeah, I think it was just keeping a sort of rhythm to it. And that was dictated by how fast or slow it should go. The problems arose... not for the late night one, because you always had plenty of time for that, but there were sometimes the 12 o'clock one, if the weather was really, really bad, and you'd have to read news for 1 minute and do 3 minutes of ships, but sometimes those ships in your original timing were 3 minutes and 35 seconds, and that's a heck of a pace that you've got to crack on to do that. And that's invariably when there were gale force 11 and, you know, really, really bad weather. So I would think, well, I hope... knowing that the sailors were listening, I would hope that they had their pencil and could write fast, because you don't want to garble it, but sometimes it was a rush to get it through. I imagined people at home listening to it, actually not often sailors, because I don't think that many of them did, but I imagined people sort of dozing off, which is probably what they did. I think it was the most soporific thing that you could deliver. And I always used to think, you know, just of one person lying in their bed, listening to that, and listening to Sailing By, and then dozing off during it, probably being woken up by the national anthem at the end. I did a lot of late shifts in my time. That was my kind of... So Wendy Cope wrote the poem Close Down and came in to watch me do a close down shift. And then wrote the poem Closed Down, which is a beautiful poem, actually. And dedicated it to me, and I was really, really chuffed about that. When I didn't know that till I saw it in print. I was very touched that she did that.
An almost empty building. Someone, all alone, reads the shipping forecast to a microphone. Listeners in bedrooms, listeners at sea. Thousands of them hear her speak invisibly. Hear her through the darkness. Hear her say good night. Picture her alone there, switching off the light.
And that completes the shipping bulletin.
I don't happen to hear Sailing By. I'm never up past midnight nowadays. Now I have a normal life and I actually go to bed and get up at normal times, like normal people. If I did hear it, I would actually... And I listen to Radio 4 all the time now. And mainly, I think, I'm glad... that's not me, because I know you're going to have a really late night, or I know you've had a really early morning. So, no, I don't really feel emotional about it. I was hugely emotional in the last one I did. Really, really. More. It took me by surprise how much it affected me to do my last shipping forecast and close down. I asked that that could be my last shift, was to do a close down so that I could say goodbye to everybody.
Well, now it's coming up to 1 o'clock, which is time to say goodnight on Radio 4 and join our colleagues at the BBC World Service, or if you prefer, tune in.
And I thought I was fine, and I went to, you know, get in my car to come home, and I was in bits, actually, really, really upset. I was going then, that was me, and I knew that that would be the last time I would do that. And I knew that a lot of people, well, perhaps more people were listening that night than usually did. And I was moved because it was the end of an era, really, and for me in my life. It wasn't the end of my working career by any means, but it was the end of my working career for Radio 4, and I was very sad about it.
Then in Open Country we visit the landscape that's believed to have inspired Never Never Land. That's just after 6 o'clock. But for now, this is Alice Arnold, not only wishing you a very good night, but also saying goodbye. It's been a pleasure, and thank you so much for listening.
I mean, I only know now that more people were listening than I think normally did. I couldn't believe, I am, you know, quite a social media addict, and I couldn't believe how many people responded on Twitter to my last broadcast, and I was incredibly touched by that. Actually, that was lovely. And Twitter was around before I left. So, Corrie Caulfield and I kind of really embraced it. And it was a great way of getting promotion for a play that you particularly liked or you wanted people to listen to. Obviously, as BBC staff then, my Twitter feed was rather more limited because you couldn't say what you really felt about a lot of things on Twitter, but it certainly was something that we used, and you did feel it was lovely, actually, because you did feel connected with your audience in a way that before you were sort of speaking into the ether, which is why it surprised me when anyone knew who I was, and then when you were on Twitter you realised that actually people did know who you were and people were following you and people knew what you did and listened to your shifts and in your news bulletins, and that was rather nice. It sort of brought it home, really.
I'm Alice Arnold, good morning.
It's interesting, I think, for lots of people in radio. I mean, you know, the name isn't particularly recognisable, but I do have incidents when I go around the world or whatever where people remember that about me and do sometimes recognise the voice. I was in a charity shop the other day and I signed a cheque to buy something, and I thought I recognised the voice when she saw the name. And, you know, my partner is Claire Balding, so obviously when we go out, I'm not the person getting the attention, I can assure you. But occasionally people will go, no, I'm not interested in Claire, actually. I was a huge Radio 4 fan, and, you know, we were on a cruise recently and there was a chap obsessed with Radio 4 and obsessed with me in Radio 4, which I always think is quite funny, because I think as a radio person, you never think of yourself as being in the limelight in any way at all. And I don't really... I'm touched if people remember my voice or liked it or say nice things. Of course I am. It would be very curmudgeonly of me not to be. But it was never something that you do to get yourself known. That's not why you do radio. You do it to communicate and because you love radio. But certainly it surprises me when people know who I am. Always surprises me.
Timeless, relaxing classics. This is Mellow Magic.
Good morning. If you've just joined us, I'm Alice Arnold, and I'm here with you this Saturday with lots of lovely music to help you ease into the weekend. Coming up, we've got Seal.
I was thrilled when I was approached at the beginning of the year by Magic Radio, which is a commercial station. We're launching a new digital outlet called Mellow Magic. And they asked if that I wanted to host a show on Mellow Magic, and I thought, well, yeah, it's not live. I go and pre-record the thing, and then I went to see Magic of the Musicals, which was a big concert sponsored by Magic Radio at the Albert Hall. And I said to my producers, "You do know this is my secret passion is musical theatre." And they said, "Well, do you want to put some of that music into your show?" I said, well, I would love to. So, I mean, the music that I play anyway is everything that I love. You know, it's Simon and Garfunkel, and it's ABBA, and it's just, you know, it's easy listening, and it's lovely music anyway. But now also I'm allowed to throw in a few show tunes just for good measure, and I can say what I like. I don't say very much. I do Saturday morning from 6 till 10 and Sunday morning from 6 till 10, and I probably only speak 4 or 5 times an hour, but I can say whatever I want, and I really thoroughly enjoy it. I'd never been a DJ before, but I love it. It's great. It's great fun. I want Elaine Page's show on Radio 2. That's ultimately where I'm heading with this. That would be my aim. Sorry, Elaine, but when you decide to leave the show, I'd be very, very happy to take over. And now I've got also going to be reading some of the long read podcasts for The Guardian. They have a massive multimedia operation at The Guardian, really impressive. I've been to see their studios, and most radio stations would be envious of the setup that they've got. And they have these long read podcasts, which are sort of 15 minute articles read out loud, and you can download and listen at your leisure. And I'm going to be reading some of that for them, so which will be rather like doing a sort of from our own correspondent kind of read, which I'm looking forward to. Well, I hope that I haven't done some of the things that I would be remembered for yet, because I still believe that I have quite a long working life ahead of me. But if people remember me as a nice, soothing voice that broadcast in a warm and friendly way, then I'd be happy with that, I think.